From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At the center of Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Position, is sex, how it shapes our lives, and how transcendent, baffling, or embarrassing it can be. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Meg Wolitzer about her novel. It begins in 1975, when four children accidentally discover a Joy of Sex-type book that their parents have written, illustrated with sketches of them making love. The novel follows the parents and their children over the decades as the book continues to reverberate in their lives. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Them, A Memoir of Parents by Francine Duplessis Gray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Position, opens in 1975 when four children, ages 6 to 15, discover a book written by their own parents called Pleasuring, One Couple's Journey to Fulfillment. It's a manual, kind of like The Joy of Sex, illustrated with sketches of the couple demonstrating the positions. Wolitzer's novel follows these characters over the next three decades as the parents divorce and age, and the children grow up and form their own relationships. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan wrote, "By its end, The Position turns out to be a poignant elegy to the fleeting health and pleasures of the body, as well as to the fleeting emotional and physical togetherness of the family." Meg Wolitzer's other books include Sleepwalking, Surrender Dorothy, and The Wife. Let's start with a reading from the opening of The Position.
The book was placed on a high shelf in the den, as though it were the only copy in the world, and if the children didn't find it, they would be forever unaware of the sexual lives of their parents, forever ignorant of the press of hot skin, the overlapping voices, the stir and scrape of the brass headboard as it lightly battered the plaster, creating twin finial-shaped depressions over the years in the wall of the bedroom in which the parents slept or didn't sleep, depending on the night. The book sat among a collection of unrelated and mostly ignored volumes, Watership Down, Diet for a Small Planet, Building a Deck for Your Home, Yes, I Can, The Story of Sammy Davis Jr., The Big Anthology of Golden Retrievers, and on and on and on. It was casually slipped in, this one copy of the book that the parents brought into the house, for if they'd stored all their copies, including the various foreign editions, in taped-up boxes in the basement marked kitchenware or odds and ends, that would have sent a message to the children. Sex is filth. Or at least, if not exactly filth, then something unacceptable to think about anywhere except beneath a blanket, in pitch darkness, between two consenting, loving, lusty, faithful, married adults. This, of course, was not the view of the parents, who for a very long time had loved sex and most of its aspects, loved it so dearly that they'd found the nerve and arrogance to write a book about it. When they thought of their four children reading that book, though, they brooded about what kind of effect it would have on them over time. Would it simply bounce off their sturdy, sprouting bodies, or else be absorbed along with the fractions and canned spaghetti and skating lessons, the things that wouldn't last, wouldn't matter, or perhaps would matter, coalescing into some unimaginable shape and gathering meaning inside them? But the parents' concern was mostly overshadowed by confidence. So why not put the book on a shelf in the den, a high but reachable shelf where the children could get to it if they wanted to? And the chances were good that they would want to, and that no one would be struck dead by it, and life would just go on as it always had.
That's Meg Wolitzer reading from the beginning of her new novel, The Position. Of course, Meg, after the children do discover this book, life does not go on the way it always had. It really changes all of their lives. And I'm wondering what made you think about having this sex manual at the center of a book, and thinking about what the consequences might be for the children if the parents had written a sex manual.
Well, for me, reading The Joy of Sex when I was a kid was a pivotal moment. My sister and I took my parents' copy and went off and read it. And the thing that struck us at the time was that this couple, he looked kind of like Kris Kristofferson, Alan Bates, the sort of bearded look that was popular at the time.
Yeah.
And she was kind of closer to my mother's age than mine. It could be your parents. I mean, there was something about this couple that was adult, and it kind of gave you a little bit of an aperture into the world of adult sexuality, ready or not.
Excuse me for sounding dumb, but I actually never read The Joy of Sex.
Oh, well, you must.
Is it actually like photographs of people?
It's drawings.
It's drawings, like in the sex manual in your book.
Yeah.
Now, your mother is a writer, Hilma Wolitzer. And yes. I'm wondering, like, when you were young, did you come across sex scenes of hers? And what impact did that have on you?
Yes, that had an impact as well. I mean, these things all kind of came together in my mind to gestate for a long time until I wrote The Position. But when I was a teenager, in junior high school, actually, my mother sold her first novel, Ending. And it was a wonderful literary book. But it did have a pretty graphic sex scene in it. And I remember going to school that day, and a bunch of boys had a copy of the book. And they ran down the hallway shouting, read page 108, read page 108. And I pretty much went home to my mother and said, why couldn't you be a travel agent? I mean, in the suburb where we lived, nobody's mother was a novelist. Everybody's mother was a travel agent or a real estate agent or a housewife. This was something pretty unusual that she did.
You know, so when the children discover the sex manual that their parents wrote and illustrated, it's not only kind of embarrassing and unsettling for them, it's also kind of baffling. Like one of the sons, Michael says, or Michael thinks, apparently no one could ever get enough of sex. It needed to be replenished again and again, filled up like a bucket in a well. It wasn't enough for people simply to have sex with each other. They also had to examine pictures of it and read about it and hear it described in agonizing and exhilarating detail. Do you think it would be baffling to a child finding one of these books to think, like, why do they have to be so absorbed in it? Why don't have to, like, read about it and write about it? And
yeah, because up to a certain age, it just simply seems disgusting. You know, I guess that's called latency, the period at which it really would kind of seem like this animalistic thing that has nothing to do with you. But of course, one day it will have everything to do with you. And I think maybe some part of your mind realizes that when you see it and you're appalled.
Now, one way of thinking about the impact such a sex book would have on the children of the parents who wrote it is that it would be sexually liberating, because it would mean they were growing up in a sexually open environment, that they got a good education from sneaking a peek at the book. But the book really becomes a burden to most of the children in your novel. And then as they grow up, this may or may not relate to the existence of the book, but as they grow up, they each have their own sexual issues. One of them is on antidepressants, and that's made him less sexually responsive and more sexually frustrated. One of the sons is gay, and nothing in the book speaks to his condition. And one of the daughters feels so unattractive, she doesn't think anyone would ever think of her as sexual. And I just find it really interesting the way you use sex in the book to get at character and to get at how people's lives are shaped, the things that shape them, the way they turn out.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you want to use sex as the kind of organizing principle around the book?
Well, I wanted sex to sort of heighten all of the emotional drama in the book about childhood and growing up and coming into your own. I realized that I couldn't think of a book that dealt with the uncomfortable relationship between sex and family. Here we all are in a family, and the adults are sexual, and the kids are secretly becoming sexual and have to hide their feelings about sex and their experiences, and everyone's living under one roof. This is all going on, but for the most part, unless you're in one of those real, you know, hippie families that I did know of, it's not really discussed. So using sex essentially as a kind of catalyst, or as a bomb, really, to sort of show how it's sort of too much exposure to sex in this family, the Mello family, who I invented, sets off a lifetime of feeling. I think it just heightens what was already there. You know, Claudia, the younger daughter, who wants to stay trapped in, you know, wants to stay in childhood, not trapped in childhood. She wants to stay in childhood because her parents were the sexual ones. She feels so unattractive that she's saving her money as a child in a Pillsbury Doughboy bank, hoping to save it up so that maybe someday she can pay a man to love her. You know, sex belongs to the parents, not to her.
One of the things you get at in your novel is the reality of sex as compared to the way it's presented in romantic literature and erotic movies. And the reality of sex is different. What are some of the differences you want to get at in the book?
Well, it's often awkward. I mean, speaking from personal experience and from things, from discussions with others, but you don't really read that very often. It's a kind of navigation between people. If they're new to each other, there's a kind of shyness or awkwardness. There's a certain stylization that we see in so much of the media about sex. And in this book, each of the children, as they grow up, has to kind of find their way in the world of sex that the parents really trailblazed before them. And the illustrations of the parents actually making love, the illustrations were so, you know, beautiful and done in pen and ink so elegantly. How can the kids live up to that? How can any of us live up to that? Things go wrong. People fall off beds. Bodies don't fit. You know, all kinds of things happen in real life.
Well, one of the great things in your book is that the parents, the couple whose illustrations are in the book, in other words, the book has illustrations of them making love, this couple doesn't live up to their own illustrations. Let me just read another passage here. And this is basically about how absurd and silly looking the reality of sex can be. You know, at first this couple thinks that they should take pictures of themselves in the positions that they want to discuss in the sex manual. So they set up a camera on a tripod with a timer, and then the woman, the wife, looks at the photos, and here's what she thinks. As far as she was concerned, she was all double chin and breast, and Paul was a shapeless Monet haystack of body hair. Everything unattractive was accentuated, and everything at all appealing seemed to have been airbrushed out. Their bodies joined together in standard missionary sex looked grotesque, their faces screwed up in pain and courage, as though the act in which they were partaking was excruciating and required a sort of personal heroism in order to endure it.
Well, the idea of a book of pictures of you having sex is so horrible that I might have to faint right now even thinking about it. You don't mind if I do. I just think that that's the truer version of sex, really, if we're not Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. You know, we're these human beings. And coming upon a book of your parents having sex in various positions, and I would like to say that the parents invent a position which they wanted to kind of give their book a certain cachet. And I really wanted to come up with the worst sort of 70s name that I could. And I spent a lot of time on this, and I came up with the name Electric Forgiveness. So the parents come up with some ridiculous position called that. Now, it's horrifying.
You also write about how life gets in the way of good sex. One of the daughters, Holly, starts off really loving sex, but it doesn't quite last. You write, she saw her parents going at it like monkeys, telling the universe that sex was a pleasure, a thrill unlike any other, a view she'd shared for about a minute when she was a teenager, and which became harder to support as she aged, and men aged too, everyone seeming to flatten against the beds they lay in, exhausted and angry, in addition to being aroused. I'm wondering if you think a lot of people are dishonest about sex and in an attempt to kind of live up to, like, what the expectations are.
Oh, yeah. I think there's so much anxiety associated with sex. I remember when I was at camp as a kid, lying in bed at night, we had all these conversations about sex. And one thing that really frightened me was that this girl, Rhonda, said that when you had sex, do not lie on your back because your breasts flatten out to the side. And I thought, well, I was really worried about this. It sort of haunted me over the years. I thought, well, I'll try a kind of side angle maybe. You know, can you have sex propped on one elbow? I really thought, you know, I feared this. I think people are very dishonest. I think they're anxious and they want to hide their anxiety. They want to sort of cover up their real selves. But the notion of sex is supposed to be about truth, I guess, isn't it? It's supposed to be about pleasure. And that is something that we've moved away from culturally so much. I mean, the book that the parents write within my novel is called Pleasuring One Couple's Journey to Fulfillment, which again is another horrible title that I wanted to come up with, because there's something embarrassing about talking about pleasure. I mean, it seems masturbatory and greedy and like you're asking for too much.
My guest is Meg Wolitzer. Her new novel is called The Position. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Meg Wolitzer. Her new novel is called The Position, and it's about a married couple who write a kind of joy of sex type sex manual in the mid-70s, using themselves as the illustrations to illustrate the positions. And the novel kind of charts what happens to this couple and to their four children over the decades. Meg, in order to write this book, you had to write about sex. And I mean, it. there isn't really all that much writing about the actual act, but there is some of it. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to get comfortable writing in a, you know, semi-explicit way about sexuality.
It took me a long time. I think that I look at my career over, you know, as this book and the last book, The Wife, I think are part of a sort of newer period for me and the period that I'm most interested in. I heard once long ago in a writing workshop, and I'm sure it's a famous line, write as though everyone you know were dead. And I think that's really the way to go. I mean, if you're writing for an audience or if you're writing because you know your mother's going to read it and what will she say, what are you doing? Why are you writing? It's not that anything in here, in fact, is anything my mother of all people, would be upset by. But you start off writing to please someone. You start off writing to please your teacher or your mother or a friend or a lover. And then you have to abandon that and you have to write what you want to write about. I started to think that men had been bolder sometimes writing about some of these issues. Philip Roth was a writer, is a writer I've always loved. And he just doesn't seem to care what people think. And I found myself stuck in a kind of writing class lyricism that I was getting upset about, in which there was very little drama and momentum. And I wanted to write more about things that mattered to me, about big things between people. And one thing between people is sex. And in this book, I wanted to sort of write about a kind of array of sexual lives.
See, I think it's really interesting. You said that you had heard the advice, write as if everybody you know were dead. But the advice people are often given is like, write as if this were a postcard or a letter to your best friend or to your parent.
Oh, I would hate that, because I think that unconsciously you sort of style things toward what the other person wants. And you have to really try to not do that. I mean, when I write a novel, I write the book that I want to find on the bookstore shelf. And I don't know what that is for most people, because these days it seems to me fiction itself has become something kind of obscure. I feel sometimes like it's like being a Mennonite or doing scrimshaw, being a fiction writer in America. People seem to want a story that's true. But I feel that fiction is the most true thing I know. And I can only write what I want to read and what excites me.
What are some of the things you had to figure out in coming up with the right tone and language to actually write the more explicitly sexual parts of the book?
Well, you know, it seems to me that writing about sex is hard to do and usually pointless, because we've all had sex. What are you going to tell me that's new? Are you telling me this to titillate me? I mean, I'm not Anais Nin. I don't want to do one of those Anais Nin Henry Miller jags. That's not what I'm after here. So if there was going to be a sex scene, it had to have a reason to be. I had to say to myself, why are you telling me this? And in each case, with the different characters, sex had a meaning that propelled the story forward and also gave us information about who they were.
How does this compare with how you previously wrote about sex in your books?
I wrote about it as though there was a misty veil over a camera of a movie. I think my own embarrassment got in the way, and I faded to black very, very quickly. Someone would kiss, or if I did a word search inside some of my books, I might find references to clavicle. He kissed her clavicle, and then it's the next day. I didn't want to do that. It seems to me cheap, and what are you afraid of? I think people are uncomfortable with sex. I mean, they still are uncomfortable with it. Maybe written by a woman, I'm not sure. I have to wait until all is said and done to find out if that's true. But again, it's not an erotic book, and it's not a particularly graphic book, but I guess it just treats sex the way it would treat going to the movies. It would treat it the way it would treat something important between two people, a conversation involving bodies and clavicles and other body parts. I just wanted to put it in there the way it's in life. That was my goal.
We talked a little earlier about about the impact that this sex manual has on the children in the novel as they grow up. And we talked a little bit about what it was like when you were a girl to find that your mother had written a novel with a sex passage in it. You have two children. How will you feel when they read your book? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, it's come up a little bit. My 14-year-old son has asked if he could read it. And first I said no, And then I thought, oh, I see. The more I say no, the more I'm going to turn this into a hot object in some way. And I don't want to do that. I said to him, well, you know, I think you would enjoy other books of mine more. This one has some sex in it. I think it might be embarrassing to you. And then the conversation just sort of ended a little bit. I mean, I think the thing that always strikes me as funny is that the children of writers aren't all that interested, for the most part, in their mother or father's work. They're sort of interested in their own lives a lot more. But when they do kind of look up from their own self-absorption now and again, and they ask about it, I bring it up as a they bring it up as a possibility, and I sort of respond in a kind of vague way, which is not unlike the way the parents in my book sort of responded. They left the book around for the children to see. Now, I'm not an exhibitionist, and this book doesn't feature pictures of me having sex in it, but I think that it's important that he know that it's a novel and that this comes from the imagination, because I think that that's the thing that's kind of falling away, the idea that a book you can write is made up and that it's not a true thing, that it's fiction and it's a work of the imagination and their mother is really proud of it. But I certainly wouldn't, you know, ban it.
Meg Wolitzer's new novel is called The Position. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Selecting the Pope, Uncovering the Mysteries of Papal Elections by Greg Tobin, available in stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Warner Home Video, announcing controversial classics, 7 new-to-DVD films, including The Americanization of Emily, starring Julie Andrews, on DVD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, having a mother who is a writer and being a mother who writes. We continue our conversation with novelist Meg Wolitzer. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Them, a Memoir of Parents by Francine Duplessis Gray. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Meg Wolitzer. We've been talking about her new novel, The Position. It opens in 1975 when 4 children discover that their parents have written a sex manual, kind of like The Joy of Sex, illustrated with sketches of the parents demonstrating the positions. The novel follows how the sex book affects the lives of the parents and their children over the next 3 decades. You know, another thing you try to get at in your novel, The Position, is the cultural meaning of sex in the 70s, like as part of the counterculture, you know, what people thought sex would be and mean, and how, you know, things were different now as the sexual revolution. People were open and not embarrassed, and, you know, it was a beautiful thing. And now, in the 2000s, you know, what does sex signify in terms of popular culture, or, you know, or home life? And I'm wondering about some of the differences you started thinking about between then and now.
Well, I think that kind of openness lasted about a minute. You know, there were all these books, How to Be Your Own Best Friend, and, you know, Free to Be You and Me. This was all about discovering the self and the pleasure that had begun in the 60s somewhat through, you know, the commune or drug use or group sex or, you know, kind of groups together, perhaps through anti-Vietnam activities, people sort of exploring who they were and what they felt. And there was a bit of a hangover of that in the 70s. But I think now there is a real shame attached to personal pleasure. I mean, pleasure that we have, as far as I can see out there in the culture, is attached to objects. You get excited and show off your kitchen, you know, with its stainless steel counters, or a car. There's really not so much about personal pleasure. It seems to have sort of gone the way of the tie-dye.
What do you think about when you watch, say, the Cialis ads, you know, which advertise, I think I have the wording straight, a stronger, more lasting experience?
What do I think? I find it such an odd moment because there is this shame, as I say, and this incredible sort of outcry against sex right now, you know, with the sort of quashing of the idea of gay marriage, or in the outcry over, you know, Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction, even that phrase. That is going on at the same time as sex is all over the place on commercials, drugs to enhance sexual experience, and Desperate Housewives with all of its innuendo. But there's a kind of crude wink-wink attitude that I find very depressing. And maybe in a way, even though the 70s and the sex that I talk about in the 70s is kind of embarrassing and was done in bad clothes or without bad clothes, it was lacking that continual sort of, you know, kind of wolfish, jokey, ironic, embarrassed quality.
Your novel, The Position, is written from multiple points of view. There are chapters from the point of view of each of the parents and each of the four children. Why did you want to write it that way?
Well, my last novel, The Wife, was the first novel that I'd written in first person. It had really taken me a long time to kind of move away from what I referred to earlier as that kind of writing class lyricism. And that was a sort of angry, funny book, The Wife. And I realized it's time to do this. It's time to let the character tell her story and have it be sometimes shrill, sometimes angry, sometimes funny, but undiluted. Don't let it get diluted by the kind of, you know, A-plus writing that you could do. Don't do that. So I wrote it that way. And when I started to write The Position, I thought, I want to also write an undiluted book, but this one, I want to go into different places. How can you go into all these beds and under all these roofs in different houses and different lives if you don't write it in multiple points of view? But then I thought, oh, God, it's going to take me into a lesbian scene. It's going to take me into the 1950s when the parents first meet, when he's her psychoanalyst. It's going to take me all over the place. And again, I thought, if not now, when? What are you waiting for? I mean, you have to try to challenge yourself as a writer. It's boring otherwise. I mean, I know some writers like to kind of write books that are similar to each other so that when you pick up their book, you get a certain kind of feeling, maybe a cozy, boxed set feeling. And I've never been that way. I just want to engage myself as a writer each time.
The novel's written in multiple points of view, and that lets us see how different characters see one another. And one of the things I found really interesting about that was the different ways that the husband and the wife see each other. You know, he is a very sexualized person, and he finds his wife quite beautiful, thinks she's really, truly the most attractive person he's ever met and the person who he's most sexually attracted to. And you read that and you find yourself thinking, how lucky she is to have a husband who finds her so just constantly and undyingly attracted. And then we read things from her point of view. And let me read what she is thinking about regarding her husband. Paul was slightly obsessive and anxious, she realized, and he'd always approached sex with her with the kind of interest that men sometimes had in wine or stereo equipment or cars. How did they taste, sound, run? Which was the best one, and what was the best way to try it out? And you realize that his obsession is with her is really not something that she's happy with. It doesn't translate well for her. And I love that description too of his sexual obsession being kind of like the person who collects stereo equipment.
Well, I've seen a kind of sort of collecting or cataloging that some men do. And I think it comes from a certain kind of anxiety, sort of like looking at what you've got. And it might feel good to a woman in the beginning to be one of those collectibles. But after a while, I think it would make her uneasy. It would make her objectified. And that, in fact, is what happens to this character. And this is coming around the time of the women's movement as well, when there's probably more awareness of the gaze and how you're viewed by men. And she can't take it anymore.
Speaking of the women's movement, what impact did it have on you?
Oh, the women's movement had a really big impact on me. I started a consciousness-raising group when I was in ninth grade, and we wrote away to the National Organization of Women for a pamphlet on topics. And they were all like orgasm and you, and we just wanted a topic like when your mom makes you clean your room. I mean, it was really so beyond us. But I was very, very aware of it, again, through my mother, who went through this metamorphosis from housewife to, you know, marcher and Birkenstock wearer in our suburb. And it was wonderful for me to see. I mean, I really grew up with it as a given. It never occurred to me that there were things that I couldn't do. I was going to be a writer. That's great. Be a writer. But I loved the trappings of it. I mean, it got a little bit much. In college, there was a class that involved a speculum, and not on us, but the teacher brought in a woman who showed us what a self-examination was like, and we got college credit for this. I couldn't believe it. As much as the joy of sex was on our shelves, our bodies ourselves was there as well. And this was another book that seems like this sepia relic from another time. I mean, I feel like I'm like when my mother talks about Deanna Durbin movies or Adolphe Manjou. Who are these people? Who are these people from her past? These are things that meant so much to me. And they're, in fact, what's interesting is that they're books. Books were really exciting, electric objects to me. I think that's happened, that's kind of sort of stopped in the culture. But what you could find in our bodies ourselves, I remember, you know, photographs of splayed women, people having sex, birth control, babies being born. You know, when I was younger, another book that had a lot of stuff in it was The Family of Man, all those photographs from around the world. And you learn about the world through these moments of shock and astonishment and secret pleasure and excitement. And I think for a writer, these things all get cataloged. There's like this intricate filing system. And from my mother's book that she wrote to seeing the joy of sex to even a moment where I remember my parents put a hook and eye on their door, you know, a tiny little hook and eye from the hardware store. And I remember hearing the sound of my father's drill. And it's like, why don't they just hang a sign on the door that says, we have sex in here? You know, I don't need to know this. And yet I know it and I'm learning it. But I'm somewhat diffusing it. I'm thinking about something else. I'm going to watch The Partridge Family. I'm doing something else. But it's staying in me to the extent that I can accept it. And I think for the characters in my book, it's staying in them to a greater extent than they want it to be there. They're overstimulated by it. It serves as a springboard to all of their, you know, sexual and emotional, professional, intellectual lives for the rest of their life. At least that was the conceit as I planned it.
My guest is Meg Wolitzer. Her new novel is called The Position. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Meg Wolitzer, and her new novel is called The Position. As we've mentioned, your mother, Hilma Wallitzer, is a novelist, too. We talked a little bit about the impact of reading a sex scene in her book when you were young. But I'm interested in the broader impact it had on you to read your mother's books. So what age did you become interested in actually reading what your mother had written?
Very early, because I don't think I really understood it. Her first short story, which was published in the old Saturday Evening Post, back when they ran fiction, was called Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. And I seem to remember that it had a drawing of a woman in a supermarket with a very white face, putting her hand over her face. And for about a minute, I worried whenever we went to King Cullen that my mother was going to have a kind of breakdown in the market because I didn't understand what fiction was. But I got it as time went on. I mean, books and reading was so much a part of my relationship with her. We cried together over Charlotte's Web. When I saw her writing, I don't think I respected it at first. I mean, I would leave the house in the morning to go to school, and she'd be sitting there in a bathrobe with her hands poised above the keyboard of a Smith Corona. And I'd come home at the end of the day, and she'd be there in that bathrobe with her hands poised above the keyboard of the Smith Corona. And I wanted to say, you know, pull yourself together, woman. What is it to be a writer? It's a slow process of acceptance on the part of a child to realize that your parent is really doing something wonderful, being an artist. It was tremendously exciting. But again, kids do want their parents to be a little bit boring. And she had enough of that suburban stuff, making, you know, salads in the shape of a girl's face and going on field trips, so that it wasn't like she was so bohemian. She really wasn't. I think that being around a writer when you're a child can be bad sometimes. My children, I think, sometimes wish that I did something else. Years ago, when my son was little, we were walking past a McDonald's, and there was a sign that said, now hiring. And he got all excited and said, look, Mom, look, maybe, you know, you could do this on the side. He wanted regular hours for me. He wanted a life that seemed stable. And I had to say to him, this is what you've got. I'm sorry. And I think that they've come to see that it's unusual and can be fun sometimes.
You know how like when you read a book by someone you know, you look to see, is any character based on you? Are there any secret messages here regarding how this writer actually feels about you?
Yeah.
So when you were reading like books by your mother, did you look for clues about how she really felt about you?
Oh, yes. In fact, there was a short story that she wrote, one of her early short stories in the New American Review, this wonderful literary magazine in the 60s and 70s. And the character, a young unhappy mother again, is sitting on the side of a bathtub washing her son's hair. And she thinks, I don't love you, kiddo. And I remember reading that and feeling some kind of deep pang. But how could it be possible? You know, she had just worked all night on my costume for Peter Pan. How could it be possible? It can't be possible, which I think gave me a sort of early understanding, a precocious understanding of the way writers make things up. But I think the way ideas come about is so sort of circumlocuous. It doesn't come directly. You don't have to not love your child in order to write that scene. But everyone is filled with ambivalence, and that's really hard for kids to see, that their mother is ambivalent, is not just an all-good, benign cookie baker, has some dark moments, has some muttering times. And I think as kids get older, they see that that's okay. I began to love it and to really respect it in my mother that she was interesting, that she had this sort of wonderful talent that seemed to come out of nowhere. Back then she was called a housewife turned novelist, as though she'd done this incredible transformation freakishly. It was so amazing to reviewers that a housewife could write a novel.
Now, I think you edited your high school and junior high school literary magazines, is that right?
Yeah, I put myself on all the pages. It's horrible. Like every page is like a poem with a picture of an hourglass. The sand falls slow, oh so slow, Meg Wallitzer. And then if you look at the hourglass, like in the corner, it says in a tiny little signature, M. Wallitzer. I was perfecting my signature. A lot of haiku, an experiment with villanelles, some woodcuts. It's essentially the all Wallitzer issue, kind of like the Hiroshima issue of the New Yorker.
I know when I was in junior high school, the people who I thought, oh, they really know how to write, they always used to they always seem to use words like myriad and plethora. So instead of there being like a lot of books on a shelf, there'd be a plethora of books on a shelf. Or instead of there being like, you know, a bunch of ants, there'd be a myriad of ants. And I thought, man, these people are really smart. They really know what they're doing. And I finally realized you don't want to throw around words like myriad and plethora unless you really need them, you know? And I was wondering if you saw a lot of that when you were editing your school magazines.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were, I remember one phrase that I saw a lot, which was, I think, you know, love fell into her arms like so much water, like so much water. Oh, that sounds like a writer did that. Really, really good. You know, we really were big on, oh, different colors in the spectrum were important, like the mauve range. You know, all you had to do was go to a Sherwin-Williams catalog and you could write poetry when you were in eighth grade. There was a lot of that. In the beginning, you think it's good. And that's how you learn to write. I mean, I've taught writing. I don't teach now, but I taught years ago. And when you're teaching writing, you find that students will write some hideous sentence right next to something absolutely fresh. And they don't see the difference. And they pretend to, but they don't get it until one day they do. And then the bad sentence stays inside and doesn't come out, and only the good sentence does. But when you're starting, you're in love with words. You have to be in love with language. You know, reading Charlotte's Web, reading Harriet the Spy, the books that I absolutely loved as a child, the language was so great. It was so, it seemed effortless. And that's what, when you start writing, it's full of sort of portentous sentences, and you're in love with yourself. It has to be like that. It's this little show of which you're the star. I used to lie in bed at night and have a TV talk show that I called, and this is for the sexual imagery alone, it's called Meg's Treasure Box. And I would sort of talk into my hand as a microphone, and now our guest tonight, our very special guest, we're really lucky to have her, is Meg Wolitzer. And I would, you know, do this because you want to have a show starring yourself. And when you start writing, you are starring yourself. I don't write autobiographically now. I mean, I haven't really ever, now that I think about it. But the thing you can't get away from in fiction is that the sensibility is yours. So even though people want to know, is this autobiographical? And you can say no. The sensibility and the humor for me, because humor is important to me, all comes from a lifetime of watching and listening and being your own personal Harriet the Spy and taking notes.
Do you yet have another novel in the works?
Yes, I'm just starting a novel right now. And it's such a pleasure. This one will be in first person again and is much more in the vein of The Wife. It's a sort of, I hope, intense, funny, dark thing about gender, among other things.
And when you start a book, is that a very good time or a very bad time?
Starting a book is the happiest time in life. It's so wonderful. The possibilities are endless. You can really think, maybe this time it will turn out okay. Maybe this time, you know, I feel like Liza Minnelli starting to sing here. I'll get lucky. It's really a great moment because it's all up to you. That's the feeling. You don't have to think about giving readings. You don't have to think about reviews. You know, I mean, I feel like reviews are something that are bad for writers because you take your pulse. Although I have a relative in my, an aunt, who you can get a terrible review in the New York Times and she calls you up and says, I saw your cute article. So you're loved by your family. But to be free of that, to be in a period where none of that matters and you're on this island of the imagination, that is better than sex.
Meg Wolitzer, thanks so much for talking with us.
No, thank you.
Meg Wolitzer's new novel is called The Position. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Francine Duplessis Gray's new memoir about her parents. Her stepfather, Alexander Lieberman, was the editorial director of the Condé Nast magazines. This is Fresh Air. Francine Duplessis-Gray is a contributor to The New Yorker magazine. Throughout her long career, she's also written many novels and works of nonfiction, including a biography of the Marquis de Sade. Now Duplessis-Gray has turned her attention to subjects closer to home. Her new memoir of her parents is called Them. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Of course, it reads like a Russian novel. How many times in the coming weeks will reviewers like me grab hold of that cliché to give a shorthand sense of the dazzling too-muchness of Francine Duplessis-Gray's memoir, Them, subtitled A Memoir of Parents? In addition to the fact that the two main players in this saga are Russian émigrés, whose tangled lives and loves toss them across the map of continental Europe, there's also the Tolstoy touch here, where history cruelly intrudes, in the form of the Russian Revolution and World War II, upon the affairs of the heart. And then there's the eccentricity of character. Most families may have one odd duck. Duplessis-Gray can boast a whole flock. Take the gambling grandfather who once designed opera houses for the Tsar, and then, after the revolution, moved to upstate New York to work for the rest of his life on a Kodak assembly line. Or the gypsy step-grandmother who, well into her 60s, hungrily picked up men for one-night stands. And the parents, particularly the parents. In keeping with the hectic excess of the world she resurrects, Duplessis-Gray memorializes not two, but three parents. Her biological father, Bertrand Duplessis, who was a hero of de Gaulle's Free French forces, died in the summer of 1940 when his fighter plane was shot down over the Mediterranean. The man who would become her stepfather, Alexander Alex Lieberman, had been having an affair with Francine's legendary beauty of a mother, Tatiana, who claimed descent from Genghis Khan. She'd also been the muse of the Russian Revolution's greatest poet, Vladimir Mayakovsky. When France fell to the Nazis, Alex, Tatiana, and Francine fled to New York City, where Alex went on to reign for decades as the editorial director of the Condé Nast publishing empire, and Tatiana became Tatiana of Saxe, a famous women's hat designer at a time when hats still mattered. In their Upper East Side townhouse throughout the 1950s and 60s, they presided over power parties that included famous friends like Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo, Salvador Dali, Christian Dior, and Coco Chanel, as well as other friends who Alex and Tatiana ruthlessly dropped when they were no longer useful. And what of young Francine? She went on not only to become, as we know, a famous writer— all the principal players in this memoir are famous for something or other, but to survive growing up in the savage company of her erratically loving, yet fundamentally narcissistic, larger-than-life parents. Clearly, Duplessis-Gray doesn't have to venture farther than her own cosmopolitan backyard to dig up fabulous stories of romance, deceit, and grief. But though her family lore is intrinsically fascinating, it's Duplessis-Gray's sensibility, her weathered intelligence as a writer, that really makes this memoir more than a curious who-was-who list of the 20th century beau monde. Reading it made me think that perhaps all writers should be required to wait until, ideally, they attain the classical distance of old age, Duplessis-Gray is in her 70s, before they start in on their parents in print. In her introduction, Duplessis-Gray says that she strove for a compassionate severity in recalling Tatiana and Alex, and that superb phrase characterizes her tone throughout. For instance, one telling detail among the thousands that she reveals about her mother really stayed with me. During her heyday, Tatiana was famous throughout New York society for a stunningly huge ring composed of a mound of rubies resembling a bishop's crozier. After her mother's death, Duplessis-Gray had her jewelry evaluated and discovered that the outrageous ruby ring was nothing but a pile of garnets. Social climber, pretender, generous and hard-working career woman who hoodwinked a fashion world in which appearances were all, Tatiana, like most people, just more so, was a nest of contraries. To her credit, Duplessis-Gray grants Tatiana and Alex and all her outsized subjects here an unruly and, yes, an occasionally repugnant humanness. You wouldn't have wanted to have lived with them. But oh, what brazenly big lives they led.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Them, A Memoir of Parents by Francine Duplessis Gray. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Brooke Shields. After a miscarriage, artificial insemination, and in vitro fertilization, Shields finally conceived and had a daughter. And instead of falling in love with her baby, she felt no connection at all. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about her new memoir, which describes her postpartum depression. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.